You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Katoa, ko Jemima Houston talk ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Tuesday, the 22nd of February. My name is Jemima and I'm your host and I'm joined in studio by producer Emily. How are you going?
I'm going well, how are you?
Good, going very well. It's a beautiful sunny day today. We've got a nice packed show, so it's all looking great. It's looking sunny, good. Which is nice. Efai Akine, coming up on the show today, I speak to Fessel Collins, who is the Manukau Ward Councillor, about his candidacy for Auckland Mayor this year and his campaign policy to make public transport free in Auckland.
I then speak to university students around New Zealand, renting spokesperson from the Green Party, Chloe Shawbrick, and a spokesperson for Renters United about renting in New Zealand.
And finally, I chat to University of Auckland Associate Professor, Clinical Psychologist and Researcher into Youth Mental Health, Kerry Gibson. We discuss the impact of social media on youth mental health. He au ofakaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces. So, tukapātui mai, you can send us through a text on 5395 or Wai Mai Rane, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Also, after the show, kaua e wariwari e ahi ana koutou, te whakarongo ki e nei kōrero anō, hei pakihiri rokiroki maronga i te pai, tukutuku o Ararangi Pōho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. We podcast everything straight after the show, so you can check it out there if you... you've got somewhere to be right now, or if you're tuning in halfway through, or if you've tuned in halfway through The Wire yesterday at midday, then you can catch all of our pieces on the website there. You can also check out all of the awesome work that the wider BFM family is doing. The BFM DJs produce some really, really awesome and super fun shows. So if there's anything out there that you're looking for music-wise, do check it out on the website as well. Anyway, we've got lots to get through today, so let's get into the show.
Irirangi Pōho, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
The next local election will take place this year, with voting taking place on Saturday the 8th of October. The local elections determine the representatives of each city council, including the mayor, and the elected members of the district health boards. In Auckland, some people have already announced that they will be running for the top spot of mayor in this year's election. Currently, Manukau Ward Councillor Fessel Collins, Auckland restaurateur Leo Malloy, returning candidate Craig Lord, South Auckland lawyer Ted Johnston, and 27-year-old newcomer to politics Jake Law have all declared their candidacy. This morning, I spoke to mayoral candidate Fessel Collins about his most recent policy announcement that he would bring fares-free public transport to Tāmaki Makaurau if he became the mayor of Auckland. We discuss why he is running for mayor, why free public transport is important and how it could be made possible, and why Aucklanders should get involved by voting or standing in local government elections. I began by asking Fessel why he decided to run for mayor.
Well, our family took some time about a year ago to really consider what our next steps were going to be. And people will be aware that my family received death threats at one particular stage mid-year last year. And we really wanted to make a commitment to ourselves and to the city as to what we wanted to give our lives for. And it was about that time that we decided we wanted to put our hand up for the Auckland mayoralty because we've got a vision for this city. city. We've got a belief that this city is our home, and I want my girls to grow up in this city and know that it's all about them too. We can address climate change. They can grow up in a city that's not going to be so interested in the colour of their skin or their postcode, but because they're little young girls who can make a serious contribution to the city. And so my vision for Auckland is to have a really connected city where people embrace one another and that we allow talent to flourish and grow. So that's why we decided, yeah, let's put ourselves forward and invite Aucklanders to consider us as their next mayoral team. I say mayoral team, but I'm the person who's standing for the mayoral position.
Yeah, I think that's awesome that you describe it as a team, though, and you talk about your family, because it is a really big decision, very big job to go into, and the impact it has on your family is, I can imagine, quite massive.
Yeah, and we experienced that last year. We've acknowledged as a family that this is something we're all a part of, that my two young daughters are just as much a part of the decision-making process in our home as is my wife, and we like to talk about these things. And look, I think that's an approach that we can take to decision-making right round, that we acknowledge that families are affected in all of our decisions, and they're hopeful for us, they're wishing us the best and cheering us on, and I'm hopeful that Auckland will see that we're a family committed to this.
I understand that you are hoping for an endorsement from the Labour Party. Could you explain why it's important to have an endorsement from a major political party like that?
Yeah, so I've stood for the role of Auckland Councillor for Manukau as part of the Labour team. And so I'm a member of the Labour Party, and I asked the Labour Party to consider endorsing my candidature because I think it's important, firstly, that Aucklanders know what my values are, that I'm all about diversity, inclusion, robust discussions and collaboration. And that, for me, is what the values of the Labour Party are. But secondly, I've already talked about having my own family beside me, and I consider myself part of the Labour whānau. And I think this is the kind of step where you want your whānau beside you, where they're endorsing you, where they're encouraging you, where they're sharing policy ideas with you. And whilst we might not agree on everything, what it does say is that I'm connected to people who want to have a say in the ideas and the policy projections that I put forward. And that's why I've asked the Labour Party for their endorsement. And that process is ongoing at the moment, and hopefully they'll make a decision in coming weeks to say who they're going to endorse. And I'm hopeful that I'm that person.
Now, let's move on to one of those policy projections. You want to introduce free public transport in Auckland. Could you explain why? Why is it important to have free public transport here in the city?
I think one of the biggest ways we can really deal to our climate emissions is to make sure that we all get out of our cars. In South Auckland in particular, many of our families drive gas guzzlers, and that's because there's a price impediment when it comes to public transport. If we had affordable, free, frequent public transport and a really good network that got into the places where people don't have to walk so far to get to a bus stop where there's a good route for the buses, and that means people are going to get out of their cars, they're going to use the bus, they're going to start walking more. And so I think it's really important that we look at free public transport for the future of Auckland. We also know the Helen Clark Foundation produced a report saying that 28% of people's income goes towards transport. So you imagine how much we're saving, and people are able to eat properly, people are able to save money for house deposits, all the rest of it, if we are able to restrict the amount of money that goes into our public transport spend just from the household perspective. And so I think it's a great policy because if we're serious about our climate action and our desire to reduce our carbon emissions, then this is the first way we can really take some real action to doing that.
How could this be made possible? Surely financing a move like this is the big question, is the big elephant in the room.
Yeah, there's a few levers that we can pull. At the moment, council spends around $50 million a year on consultants of HR and legal services. We've got our own HR policy team and our own legal services team in council, so I can't understand why we're spending all that money. We currently pay around $300 million in GST to the government when people are paying their rates. Just those figures alone would more than pay fares-free public transport. So there is money. It's just a matter of working collaboratively with the Crown to get that GST back and allow Aucklanders who are paying that GST to then spend that money on something that's going to benefit the city. Projections tell us, there are estimates that vary, but anywhere between $100 and $176 million is what it will cost to get fares-free public transport. So the figures I've given you show that we could pay that and more if we were to pull the levers that are available to us now.
And do you think if a policy like this came into place, that it would be a blanket policy right across Auckland, one day there would be fares free, or would it be something that would be rolled out and tested perhaps in different wards or even in different forms of transport? So perhaps fares free for buses, but ferries are coming later.
Yeah, great question. I think the ambition for me is fares-free public transport, but I'm already hearing people saying, well, why don't we trial it? Why don't we just make it a fares-free for tertiary students? Let's look at children across the board. We've got fares-free for children on the weekends. Let's make it every day of the week. The government's introducing in July this year, we understand, the Connect Community Card, which is for people to use to get 50% off their current fares if they're on low incomes. So there's already thinking in this area, and I'm willing to talk with people, but I think we've got to keep our ambitions high, understanding that it's such a price or cost impediment that people are having to overcome to get on the buses in the first place. But secondary to that, or probably even more important, is the fact that we've got to address our climate emissions, and we know that most of our emissions in Auckland, almost 50% of it, is coming from kilometres we travel in our vehicles. So we can definitely pay it, and we can phase it in with the ultimate goal of making it fares-free.
Why do you think people should vote in the local elections here in Auckland? Voter turnout is often low when it comes to local government elections. So is there anything you can say to encourage people out there to get out and vote this year in the local election?
I want people to know that their vote makes a difference, and we know that we have lower participation rates in local government elections. I think there's some kind of meso factors that are related to this, but immediately in front of us, I think people need to think about our libraries, our parks, our recreation centres, swimming pools, MOTAP, the zoo. All of these facilities are provided to you by council, so you're making a contribution to it through your rates, and it's important that the decisions that are made around the council tables are decisions that represent your views, and so it's important that you vote. And I want to encourage students in particular, I know there's lots of students listening to BFM, but this is something where we can make a serious impact. I know for many of our young people, climate action is imperative to be able to sustain a future that is going to be fair and just for all of us. So voting in these elections is really important. And another aspect to it would be, I want to encourage people to stand. I think this is an opportunity for people to put their ideas, their ambitions for the city forward. So don't just vote, make sure you stand so that you can put yourself forward and allow the public of Auckland to really test and grapple with the ideas that come during the local government election.
That was Manukau Ward Councillor Fessel Collins speaking about his candidacy for Auckland Mayor this year and his policy on free public transport if he does become the Mayor after the election later this year. You're on The Wire on 95BFM. If you have any thoughts on the pieces on the show today, do send us through a text on 5395. We'll be right back after this. Let's hear it for everyone's favourite garden city. Yeah. Hamilton, city of the future, the rest of you will never catch up. Not to mention the dairy-free options.
Yes. Well,
Shaky Isles Coffee, brewed different for entree enjoyers and hometown heroes. Go to shakyisles.co.nz.
Hakarongo mai, it's Māori words, because he waka eke noa.
Noku te whiwhi. Lucky me, my gang.
In the audience we have Howard Morris.
Oh, what did I miss? Not much. Everyone's just talking about how much they love farmers.
Well, noku te whiwhi. Looks like I just got electoral debate bingo.
I wish I was a farmer.
Noku te whiwhi. Lucky me, my gang.
Māori words. Karawhiua. Give it a go.
Crispness. Browbone. Prestidigitation.
These words and more, available now at UBIC, your one-stop shop for textbooks, stationery, and all your general literary needs. Course-specific words like gestalt and rhizomatic. All-time classics like chess and hello. Get your semester one course books and more at UBIC. Big words, big emotions. Pop in store Monday to Friday, 8:30 to 5:30 at number 2 Alfred Street, or online at ubiq.co.nz.
Daddy, Daddy, what have you brought me from your travels?
For you, my child, oranges from Spain.
Daddy, Daddy, have you a gift for me?
For you, my sweet, this carved jade badger from the Khotan region of China.
And me, Daddy?
Ah, for my favourite, a white label cameo 12-inch all the way from the land of the good groove.
This slaps, Papa!
Land of the Good Groove with the legendary Murray Kamik.
It's Murray Kamik.
Who's that lady? Who's that lady?
Land of the Good Groove. Every Friday, 1 to 2 p.m. Only on 95 BFM.
B-Wire. Their relationships with their girlfriends or their wives. Wife. No one. They shouldn't have more than one wife at a time.
Renting in New Zealand is a form of living that a lot of Kiwis experience. Over time, complaints regarding the quality, fairness and accessibility of renting and flat hunting in New Zealand has risen, with the housing crisis upping the prices of flats while the quality remains the same. University students who are new to the renting game often find themselves receiving the short end of the stick, with many having to flat in unsafe and uninsulated flats with little aid from landlords or property managers. I spoke to three university students in New Zealand about their experiences and thoughts on the current state of renting and flatting. Adam and Kate are attending Victoria University in Wellington, while an anonymous student is attending Auckland University in Auckland. First, I asked them what their experience with flatting and flat hunting as a student was like. You will hear Adam and Kate in Wellington speak first, then the anonymous student in Auckland.
Could you tell me a bit about your flatting or flat hunting experience?
In 2021, I went out to find a flat, and we really struggled then. We had no landlord references or anything, and we eventually found one through a friend of a friend. But this place was not up to scratch at all. It was incredibly cold and very moldy. So like your breath would fog up inside, your clothes couldn't dry. You know, we cleaned mold from windowsills and everything every 2 weeks. And the really frustrating part was, it turns out the landlord knew about all this, because when they did the final property inspection the other day, they came through and were like, haha, yeah, this place prepares you for living in the Antarctic. And we're like, so you knew how terrible this place was, but you still charged us $900 a week. So we then...
When I first started looking for places out of halls, it was near impossible. It's really leaky. I had basically like what I'd call a sprinkler system in my room, essentially. I had these doors that like weren't sealed shut properly and water used to come in. And then I had a window, one functioning window, which water also used to come into. And so I told my landlord about that and he said, why don't we seal it shut? So the idea is that I'd be living in a room with no opening windows or any sense of airflow for $230 a week with no expenses. Flat number two had like black mold growing in our wardrobes. told our landlord about that, and he just kind of went, oh, well, that's just a part of really the Ara Valley living. If you're not happy, then you can leave, kind of thing. And you get pretty desperate. Yeah, you get pretty desperate in Wellington to like find a place. So we just kind of settled there for a bit. Yeah, and now I'm living the dream in a really nice flat, because it's not what you know, but who you know.
We took over a friend's flat at the beginning of last year. I guess probably the most important thing for you to know is that we essentially had no heat pump and no insulation for the entire year, which was really frustrating. Never had a single flat inspection, and our property manager just pretty much wasn't present, which was really frustrating for the entire flat. Talked to the property manager about getting a heat pump, and she said, oh, can you talk to the landlord? And I mean, that's their job as a property manager, is to be the point of contact between the tenants and the landlord. So that was incredibly frustrating. Luckily, we've got a new property manager now and she seems pretty switched on. But yeah, I think it's quite important that property managers get held to a certain standard, because living in a moldy home that you're paying a ridiculous amount for is just, it's not really on.
Adam also expanded a bit on how difficult it is to find a flat hunt, to find a flat while hunting as a student.
You go to a viewing, right? And then you get the link for the application form, the online applications in through you. They all use the same, they all pretty much use the same website for it. It's the Trade Me one. I think it's called Renty. And you have to upload, they do like a credit check, and you upload a photo of your face, and you have to get like as many references as you can collect. Landlord references, they sort of say a landlord reference isn't essential, but it could really help. But what really annoyed me was that you could pay $25 to get your profile pre-approved. Mm-hmm. I don't know, I'm until this day, I'm not entirely sure what it did, but I was so scared on missing out or being at the bottom of any sort of a list that I paid the $25. And after about 24 applications, we got absolutely nothing. Along the way, you don't really interact with any person either. You, a lot of the people at the viewings actually have no idea about the place. Like, it's their first time setting foot in it as well, because they're just sent by the rental management company. It's like you ask them a question and they have to look through their sheets of paper to see if they have an answer. And half the time they're like, I don't know, I've never been in this place before. And that's the only time you ever meet another real person.
Then I asked them what changes they would like to see in the process and laws of renting in New Zealand that would improve flatting for university students. Again, you will hear Adam and Kate in Wellington speak first, than the anonymous student in Auckland.
What sort of changes would you like to see to prevent these sort of unfair flatting examples from happening in the future?
You can't really afford to piss off your landlord, whether justifiably or not, because then you feel like you're sort of locked out of the market. But the process seems needlessly obtuse and opaque.
Just less landlords like ripping people off. It's just getting a little bit ridiculous. I mean, like a mouldy flat shouldn't cost someone $250 a week. Some hike prices up to a ridiculous point, and then when you complain about it, say, well, not my problem, like, so someone else will move in. And it's true, they will, because people are desperate. So I mean, maybe let's not try and capitalize on students' desperation to have a roof over their head.
I think maybe more accessible help for students. I spent a lot of time on the phone with the tenancy tribunal just trying to work out what we could do, but there really wasn't a lot that we were able to do. And yeah, so just really clear standards that landlords need to uphold, and also holding property managers to a certain standard.
With these experiences in mind, I then spoke to the Green MP for Auckland Central and spokesperson for renters in the Green Party, Chloe Schwarbrick, on the subject of renting New Zealand. Over the past few years, the Green Party has been vocal about the need to improve the structure and quality of renting in New Zealand, with their aim to make renting reasonable. I first asked Chloe about her opinion on the current state of renting in New Zealand. So, as a Green MP who is involved in the subject of renting in New Zealand, what do you think about the current standard of rentals and flatting for a lot of first-time and early renting students?
Frankly dire, and it has been for a really long time. I think just on that point of how it's been this way for a really long time. Unfortunately, we have a tendency in, I think, some of our kind of rhetoric and culture to rationalise that because stuff has been bad for past generations that we have to continue to make it bad, that it's somehow this rite of passage or what have you. To that effect, we know that Aotearoa New Zealand has some of the lowest quality housing in the world, and the developed world in particular, where we have started to see that diseases that have been totally eradicated in places like Australia, just across the ditch, continue to harm particularly children in rental properties. And this is not a small problem. 1.4 million New Zealanders rent. So when we're talking about the reality of what it is to live in a warm, dry, healthy home, we need to talk about that not just for the two-thirds of people who own and live in their own home, but also for those who rent.
Following on from that, I talked to some university students who are currently flatting or renting across New Zealand, and a common issue that kept coming up was renters would bring these issues that they had with the flats, and oftentimes landlords wouldn't do anything. However, students were too afraid to push back more because they needed the flat that they are in because there's such a high demand. How do you think we can hold landlords and property managers accountable when they feel like they don't need to be?
Yeah, one of the things that has frustrated me immensely about the kind of debate that we've been having about particularly rentals in the past kind of 4 or 5 years is that it's effectively been about all of the little piecemeal, tiny things that we can twiddle around the edges and try and fix. We haven't been able to engage in any meaningful way with a complete transformation, if you will, which obviously is, of course, what we're all promised in 2017, of the system. So if you want to talk about, you know, moving away from, sure, the healthy home standards are great, but at the end of the day, they still require that it is the tenant or the flatmates who will go and try and enforce those against the landlord or the property manager through things like the tenancy tribunal. And as you say, there's already such a deep imbalance of power that people are terrified of being blacklisted, even if that's not formally or otherwise. But then you've also got, on the other side of things, if there are issues with regard to rental prices not being at market level, that, again, the incumbency is on the tenant to go and complain to the tenancy tribunal. So you can see a pattern emerging. The way that we can resolve this is through what is known as a register of property managers and landlords. And this is something which we've seen work incredibly well in places like Scotland. If you see that as the basis of the way that we do things in this country in rental properties, then you effectively come to know things that we actually still don't know in Aotearoa. We don't know specifically how many landlords there are in this country. Meanwhile, we know for a fact that we have 1.4 million renters, because that, of course, is reflected on consensus. And therein, you can start to unpick how those with power and wealth and otherwise are able to organise their affairs so that they are relatively untouchable, whereas those who are needing that support or in an unbalanced, unfair playing field are having to constantly expose and give all of themselves over in these really unfair relationships, which continues to perpetuate these problems. So with a register, you effectively have a obvious registration of landlords and of property managers. And in doing so, there is a kind of licensing scheme which says, hey, if you're going to do this, this is not a regular kind of business. You are required to have a certain level of education about your rights and your responsibilities in this role, because, again, recognised at the United Nations is the human right for access to adequate housing. Then, if there are bad actors who continue to do the same bad things again and again and again, they, of course, like with any other profession, will be blacklisted from that profession and unable to continue doing it again and again and again. So this is one of the most basic ways that we can fold in things like a rental warrant of fitness, which, of course, right now is, you know, kind of the healthy home standards, but without the requirements that there's a sticker or a licensing prior to somebody moving into that house, but also that we make sure that those who are engaged in this kind of business actually are up to professional standards.
And going on a bit from that, we've mentioned how there is this general issue about renting for all sorts of people in New Zealand. But do you feel like the concerns from families and professionals who are renting in, let's say, kind of nicer, more well-established homes and renting areas, do you think that they're treated more seriously when they bring issues to the table than students who were renting out?
Oh, I think that inequity compounds. It's really obvious that if you are a student who is in your first flat, you are far less inclined than somebody who is a young professional who's maybe been around the traps a few times to know what your rights are, let alone to feel comfortable and complaining about it. So it's definitely the case that actually, if you talk about even Tāmaki Makaurau, that some of the worst rental housing stock in this country is in South Auckland. But we don't hear all too much about that. We don't hear all too much about, you know, the situation with regard to overcrowding or just how dire and how unupdated those buildings are. Because, again, there's a compounding of inequity. And that's why it's critically important that we ensure that we raise the floor so that everybody is able to live in high-quality, warm, dry, secure housing, whether they own or they rent.
If you'd like to fill out the Green Party's survey regarding renting, as well as see what ideas they have to improve renting in New Zealand, you can go to greens.org.nz/reasonable_rents. Finally, I spoke to Renters United spokesperson Anna Bykova. Renters United is an advocacy group in New Zealand which aims to campaign and be a voice for renters across the country. Their mission is to aid in improving the fairness and standard of renting. I first asked Anna what sort of work Renters United does. So could you give me a brief explanation of what sort of work Renters United has done or is doing to aid renters in New Zealand?
So Renters United believes that everyone deserves safe, stable, healthy housing, regardless of any other factor that they may have, and the part that we take up in the sector is that we advocate for renters in what we believe is an imbalanced and under-regulated market.
A lot of first-time renters, such as university students, often feel as though they've been taken advantage of by landlords due to their lack of renting experience. How do you think this sort of thing could be avoided?
So there are a bunch of ways that this could be avoided. One way that it could be avoided is by renters knowing their rights a bit more. So there are things that landlords and property managers can and can't do. But on a larger level, renters knowing their rights sometimes isn't enough for their rights to be enforced, because we believe that we've got quite a power imbalance between renters and property managers that results in lots of widespread non-compliance, even if legislation is in place to prevent kind of unfair practices.
Renters United encourages people to share their stories with you. How has this influenced the aims and targets of your advocacy group?
So sharing stories can help regular New Zealanders understand that the legislation that we've got in place is not working on an enforcement level and on a sort of ground level. A lot of people may think that because we've got rules in place that stipulate that we should have fair trading, that these rules are followed, but that unfortunately is not the case. And so if there is more attention drawn to the cause, maybe people will understand that some oversight is required. Like, one of the ways that we would be keen to see this regulated as if there was a government agency or something sort of like the Commerce Commission, like an industry agency that could oversee breaches and be like fines for them, so that it disincentivizes property managers from doing it, because at the moment it seems like there isn't enough to disincentivize widespread non-compliance.
As an advocacy group who's quite large in New Zealand and you've been helping a lot of people, do you feel as though the government is interacting enough with renters and renting advocacy groups to make change?
Definitely seems like some of our stories are not being heard. There are some things that are being done by the government that are seen as quite good moves by us. For example, we've got the plan to fix renting, and the government is implementing some parts of it. I definitely want to bring up the proposed property manager licensing scheme that has been brought up by the government in the last couple of weeks. That's exactly the sort of oversight that we would be interested in seeing. And so that's definitely quite a positive move from a renter's perspective.
And finally, going forward, in what ways do you want to see the culture and system of renting change in the future?
So going forward, one of the things that Renters United would like to see is proper regulation that works. There's very little regulation in the rental market. Almost every other commercial transaction can be investigated by the Commerce Commission. Vehicles will have a warrant of fitness that shows they're roadworthy. Even sort of other parts of the real estate market, the housing market, such as the real estate market, are regulated. The real estate market is regulated by the Real Estate Authority Act. And renting is quite unique in the fact that it isn't. So we would like to see more proper regulation. We'd also like to see an authority or a tenancy tribunal that works on an investigative model. At the moment, the tenancy tribunal is more closely linked to the Small Claims Court rather than things like the Commerce Commission. So the difference is that the onus falls on the party that feels that it has been wronged, so the tenants, to make a complaint. And that kind of puts tenants in a difficult position, because when we stick up for our rights like this, we risk damaging our relationship with the property manager, and we risk even damaging our future accommodation chances. Property managers have been known to blacklist problematic tenants or tenants that raise complaints. So there's definitely a power imbalance that we would like to see shift, where the regulation of the system is in everybody's interest, not in just the renter's interest.
In 2018, Renters United launched their plan to fix renting. It lays out 26 changes they wish to see laws surrounding renting in New Zealand happen in order to ensure fair, affordable, safe and stable renting for all. Many of these changes do line up with the issues and ideas for change the renters I spoke with said. 5 days ago, the Labour government announced a scheme to require property managers to need a licence that would be renewed annually. This would act as a form of registration and make property managers be subject to investigation and penalties if they break the code of conduct. This, however, will not be applied to landlords who still remain unregistered. Associate Housing Minister Porter Williams has stated that although more options are being looked at to help struggling renters, it is too early to reveal a complete plan by the Labour government on rent controls. If you're interested in learning more about Renters United's plan to fixing renting, or want to show your support to them by donating, you can find all of this information on their website at rentersunited.org.nz. Also, if you want to hear more on renting in New Zealand, A Room of One's Own is a fortnightly segment on The Breakfast Show here at BFM. Celine, a renting advocate associated with Renters United, speaks with Rachel on the show and answers listeners' questions and provides handy tips about renting. The next time you can hear her is Monday, March 7th at 9:30 a.m. Send through a text to 53595 between now and then to have your renting questions answered.
Thank you so much, Emily. You're on the wire on 95BFM. If you have any thoughts on Emily's massive, awesome piece that she just produced there, do send us through a text, 53995. Let us know your worst renting experience or perhaps some thoughts you have about how renting could change in New Zealand. We'll be right back with one last piece after a wee break.
This is a radio ad for Hop Butcher.
New Leaf Kombucha's trademark non-alcoholic beer, made on site at their New Leaf Kombucha tap room in Ponsonby.
Hop Butcher is gluten-free and guilt-free, with no additives, no colourings, and no preservatives. Brewed using pure kiwi hops, it's everything you love about beer without the beer.
Come and try a free sample at the New Leaf Kombucha tap room, 37 Crummer Road. Working from home? They've got you covered. Order online at newleafkombucha.nz for free Auckland shipping.
New Leaf Kombucha. Hangover sold separately.
Radio ad over.
Hey, it's Doug here with the Little Kalimba. The Broadcasting Standards Authority wants your views on proposed changes to broadcasting rules. They help ensure freedom of expression without harm on radio and TV. Submissions close on 8th March 2022. For more details, go to bsa.gov.nz.
It's music.
Go to 95bfm.com for show podcasts.
Put on your dancing shoes, bitch.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
You're on the Tuesday Wire on 95BFM. Just for anybody who was interested, that last song I played there was Clubbing in the Time of Cholera by Babies Ionov, and that's the Deep State Pure Rave remix. For our final piece today, with many people back in isolation due to the Omicron outbreak, it is likely we're all going to spend a lot more time on our phones and screens. I have certainly found myself in previous lockdowns spending far too much time on my phone on social media. My screen time data on my iPhone during those times was honestly pretty embarrassing. But not only was my time on a screen reflected in my phone's data, it was reflected in my mood. I found myself feeling down and comparing myself to people on holiday in beautiful looking destinations across the world, or looking at someone's super cool makeup look on TikTok while I'm lying in my bed in the same sweatpants and t-shirt uniform I'd been wearing day in and day out of lockdown. After this, I wanted to interview someone about whether my experience was something other young people were experiencing online. I spoke to University of Auckland Associate Professor, Clinical Psychologist and Researcher into Youth Mental Health and Social Media, Kerry Gibson. We speak about how social media is impacting the mental health of young people, how people are dealing with platforms that make them feel bad, and what choices we can make to ensure our social media experience is as positive as possible. Here is Kerry now. Your research specialises in youth mental health. Are there any trends as to what impacts the mental health of young people that you can speak to?
So in terms of the trends that come up for them, the issues that are important for young people today, I think there are three or four issues. First is young people feel a lot of pressure to succeed today. So it seems like there's just more and more pressure on them to kind of do well, to shine in the world, to kind of make a success in their lives. And, of course, social media interacts with that as they kind of look at each other's profiles and they see how well their friends are doing, and it feels like they really need to kind of prove themselves. So that's an enormous pressure, and that pressure comes from all sorts of places, partly from social media, but also a lot from, you know, the expectations of family, and kind of the broader social expectations of young people today, that, you know, that they can make all these choices, that the world is their oyster and they can choose what they want to be. One person said to me, her parents say to her, you know, you could be the prime minister if you want. A lot of loneliness, a lot of young people are feeling really lonely. It's harder to connect than ever before. We're all in these kind of big institutions. We've seen the loss of some of those, you know, more traditional places that we used to belong to for some people, like the loss of church, the, you know, governments don't hold the power that they used to. People have to work harder today to find their own social connections and can feel kind of really isolated along the way. Well, even though we supposedly very tolerant society here in New Zealand, there's still an awful lot of discrimination and stigma. A lot of racism is alive and well. And of course, then you add COVID into this mix, and you've got, you know, a lot of those problems are compounded, particularly the isolation that young people have experienced has been quite profound during COVID, the periods of lockdown and so on, and the difficulty, you know, I don't know, my sense is a lot of students are struggling to get back into the habit of coming onto campus, and so that sort of, you know, although it seems easier to stay at home, that's also kind of adding to their sense of disconnection and isolation.
I definitely feel like COVID particularly has brought about a sense of loneliness, but it was also interesting that point you made about that although we have all these connections available and all these opportunities to be part of these different communities online and across the world now, it's almost too much choice.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is, you know, an alarming array of options that people have with social media and so on. But, I mean, I think that I also do want to say quite firmly that some of these problems are not about social media. So often we make social media this kind of scapegoat for everything. So it's sort of like particularly adults want to say, you know, oh, young people are anxious today. It's because of social media. Meantime, they're forgetting the fact that they've been putting enormous pressure on their young people to kind of do well. In fact, the realities of young people's lives today are very difficult. It's very hard to survive economically. Jobs are not as easy to come by. People are having to kind of spend many more years in education to be able to kind of get a reasonable career. You know, young people are feeling like they will never own their own home in the way that the previous generation did. You know, it's a really difficult situation when people feel that they're under pressure to kind of be their best self, to do the best they can, and yet knowing that they won't be able to get the things, many of the things that the previous generation has valued.
I want to talk a little bit about that comparison issue that comes with, you know, society now and, you know, the inclusion of social media in it, but also that pressure to succeed. Is social comparison a problem? Do you find that young people are comparing themselves more than ever? Does that impact people's mental health?
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt about it. I mean, that is one of the most harmful elements of social media, is that sort of, you know, very obvious kinds of comparison that people can make. So they can look at how many sort of friends they have compared to somebody else. They can look at what you're doing on the weekend and how much more exciting their friend's weekend is than their own weekend, you know, the job they've got, the new clothes they've got, the brilliant degree they got. So that kind of comparison is really unhelpful. But again, you've got to remember that in a way social media reflect a lot of the unhealthy dynamics in society more generally. Sure, it kind of amplifies them, but it doesn't make them completely.
Something that I've sort of been interested in is social medias like Instagram and TikTok. Comparison is a really serious thing. Like, I think you're no longer looking at, you know, the women's weekly magazines and comparing yourself to a celebrity. You're comparing yourself to somebody that is meant to be a peer or meant to be just like you. Which I just wonder whether that is something you've seen potentially causing more of a decline in people's mental health, perhaps, than it was comparing yourself to, I don't know, Kim Kardashian, who is, you know, so wealthy and so, you know, you're never going to be able to reach that. But comparing yourself to somebody down the road that's just bought a nice house is perhaps more relatable.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, that is, as I say, you know, that's one of the worst aspects of social media. But I tell you what I found in my research is that many young people like you are actually seeing through that stuff. They are very savvy about social media and what it's doing to them. I think that while that is a danger, I don't think young people are just sort of the passive victims of social media. I think that they are thoughtful and often making quite careful choices for themselves at best about how to manage some of the pitfalls of social media and looking instead for ways to use social media that actually benefit them. And of course, there are plenty of ways that social media benefits people. It can provide opportunities for amazing connection with a like-minded group of people. You can find out information about how to manage your mental health online. So what's important is about people learning to manage it.
And do you think those choices that young people are making when they're looking at social media and thinking about how it might be impacting the way that they feel or the way that they're acting, in your research, what are some of those choices that you've seen?
What I'm seeing is young people being very selective about who they communicate with. So having, you know, those kind of secret groups or, you know, layers of friendship groups where they can share more personally and with a group of people that they actually trust, or checking out what kind of rules there are in a forum for engaging before they take part in it and before they make themselves vulnerable. Some people are kind of going, whoops, I don't like what I'm doing now with Instagram, you know, scrolling all the time, and I'm going to stop doing that, and I'm rather going to go for Spotify. Private messaging rather than sharing publicly. Young people seem to be getting much better at kind of taking those precautions to ensure that they're safe. And so I talk about kind of emotional safety online, and that's about that young people are learning, and we can help them learn, and they can help us learn how to make sure that they're safe in their engagements with others, so that they're choosing to share things in ways that sort of still protect themselves, and also learning to engage gently and kindly with one another. I think for other people, it's really about choosing which ones and how, knowing which are bad for them, which should they come away from thinking, oh, that's just made me feel much worse about my life. and which has helped them feel more connected, more, you know, empowered.
That was University of Auckland Associate Professor and Researcher into Youth Mental Health and Social Media, Kerry Gibson, speaking to me about how social media is impacting the mental health of young people.
That was The Wire.
Ko-era te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki. That brings us to the end of the Tuesday Wire for another week. Hope you enjoyed the show today. Thank you very much for listening, and thank you for sending through your texts and giving us a call. We always love to hear your feedback and your thoughts on the pieces we cover on The Wire, so do always keep those rolling through for us on these shows on 5395. Massive thank you to Emily for producing today. How do you feel it went?
Good. It was a bit of a marathon for me, but I enjoyed it.
It was a marathon, but it was awesome. It was, yeah, so, so cool. So thank you very much. Big thank you as well to the people who spoke with us for the show today. Always so awesome how much time we're given by these great experts and people in the public that have, you know, opinions and thoughts about what's going on in New Zealand and across the world. So massive thank you to them. We hope you have a wonderful afternoon out there and that you're taking care of yourself and taking it easy. I hope it's sunny where you are. It's sunny here. I hope it's sunny where my grandma is, and if she's still listening. It was nice to see you yesterday. We will catch you very, very soon. Have a good afternoon. Mā tiwa.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.